Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. It's Wild Card Wednesday, so get your requests in. Any artist, anything, any song. 312-981-7200 for Wild Card Wednesday. 312-981-7200. Yesterday was the 4th of July. Celebrations all over the place, celebrating America and America's independence. And we wanted to talk to an author who has written over 60 books, including many on baseball, America's pastime, and many on the American experience itself. He's a terrific writer and a great guest, and we always have a great time when he joins us. And let's welcome to the show Paul Dixon. Paul, how are you?
Tremendous, Nick. How are you today?
Good, good. Always great to have you on the show, Paul. I really appreciate you joining us.
I'd love to be on your show.
Thank you. Tell everybody a little bit about your background and some of the books that you've written. And I want to talk particularly, we'll talk a little bit about your baseball books and a little bit about the books that you've written about the American experience as well.
Well, I was born in 1939, so you can do the math. So I'm an older guy, but I've written over 60 books. And I've enjoyed that immensely. You start out as a journalist, Navy veteran, and I write about whatever sort of stirs the pot at the moment. I've written a lot of books about baseball, but I've written books about, American history. I've done some humor, books on American language. I've just sort of done what it sort of kicked. In a funny way, it's almost like an adolescent dream that you, rather than cut hair or be a lawyer or something, you get up every morning and start writing about or researching and looking into something that you really are interested in. Two things that always interested me are were at space exploration and baseball, and I've written a lot of books about both of those things. So it's in a funny way, it's sort of an adolescent's dream. Like you just do what you want, and you don't have to go to meetings all the time.
Oh, that's certainly incentive right there.
Yeah,
to not go to meetings. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're a great writer, Paul. It's always a great time to have you here. And we figured since it's, very patriotic week and everything, that we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the American stuff that you've written. One of the things that I really found fascinating, and I know that you are really fascinated with phrases and words. You've written a lot about language.
Yeah.
And it's also something that I'm fascinated by. Words from the White House, words and phrases coined or popularized by America's presidents. Now, how did you go down that road to write that book? And tell me about it.
It's really, I'm glad you asked the question that way, because what happened was really interesting to me was I found out quite by sort of a fluke. I was doing something else. And I found out that the word Founding Fathers was created by Warren G. Harding. And he created it as a negative. He said, the Founding Fathers would never want us to do this. The Founding Fathers would never do that. And it was a word that he used to sort of bash other people over the head, but it didn't exist before Harding. And I kept saying, well, it changed our whole perception. Before that, they were called the Framers, which is a much less powerful phrase than Founding Fathers, which makes them sound they all worked in unity. Then I found out that it was Roosevelt that created the term State of the Union. And I kept looking at all of these terms, Eisenhower and military industrial complex, and the many terms created by Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin D. Roosevelt had a bunch of them, really interesting, like iffy. And one time he said the Supreme Court just made an iffy decision, and the whole country went crazy. They said, well, that's not a word. How can you say iffy? So it was just sort of it was a exercise in sort of seeing how language changes, but through the President of the United States.
Now, so when you were researching this, I mean, obviously, it sounds to me like your initial response was that you were completely surprised by the history of the term Founding Fathers. And when I read that, what you wrote, I was shocked by that too. I thought it was a much older term.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of that stuff, and a lot of it was the founders themselves, the early guys, did it on purpose. I mean, Jefferson and Adams really believed that we had to establish an American identity. So they thought creating new words was almost like poking the British in the eye with a stick. I mean, they were intent. And, of course, the British would go crazy in the early days when we would pick up a term from a Native American language. When we said creek instead of brook, the British would go crazy because it came out of a an Indian background rather than an Anglo-Saxon or Latin Greek background. So, you know, it was really fun because the early guys just loved to make up terms. And you know, Jefferson made up a separation of church and state. It was never really stated that way until he gives a speech in which he said, we believe in the principle of the separation of church and state. So, you know, it's phrases. Eisenhower did wonderful jobs, you know, with military-industrial complex, but he had a lot of others that he created. And probably the leader, Teddy Roosevelt probably created more, like Lunatic Fringe and things like that.
Yeah, the background on Lunatic Fringe is one of my favorites. Tell everybody what he referenced, the Lunatic Fringe.
Basically, he was talking about the famous armory show where the first impressionists showed off the new descending staircase and the early, you know, really modern art, and he just looked upon that and called that the Lunatic Fringe. but it's a wonderful stuff. So yeah, that the language stuff really intrigues me. And you know, I did my baseball dictionary, and I did another one about words created by writers. And I mean, the first person to use in a book, they were earlier, but the first person ever to use the word baseball in a book was Jane Austen.
What?
In Northanger Abbey. Yeah, she says, there's a line, and it's, she wrote this in 1817, and she says in the book, the girls stayed in the house and the boys went outside to play baseball. It's written as two words, but they found several earlier or later, they found it in the newspaper, but it's the first novel, the first book in which the word baseball appears. So I found that, and they're still trying to figure out what she meant. It was probably some rudimentary thing like rounders where you ran back and forth between two bases, because the concept of base in sports predates baseball by centuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even in hide and seek, you have home base.
Right.
But when you start playing with language, it clears the sinuses. because you make these discoveries, you go, what? You know?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. I'm the word Ottoman.
Yeah, that was Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah. Oh, now what? How does that happen?
Nobody knows. And it was for the furniture, not for the Ottoman Empire. But
right. Right.
For the chair or for the footstool. You
right.
Know? I mean, you can't, I mean, Shakespeare gets credited with anchovy, which I just found fascinating. I wonder if Shakespeare had a pizza with an anchovy.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, now, what about the personal shopper? Who was responsible
for that? That was Jackie Kennedy.
That was Jackie Kennedy?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. And now, if you're going to update this, are you going to include Bigley?
I don't know. You know, it didn't enhance the language. It didn't give us a new insight. It's because nobody really knew if he was saying big league or big league.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't a. But I mean, Obama, President Obama, still gets. Snowmageddon was really his.
Snowmageddon, yeah.
For the, you know, the big, big snowstorm.
You're right. Yeah. Okay. So, well, fascinating stuff. And that is words from the White House, words or phrases coined or popularized by America's presidents. Really amazing stuff. By the way, we have a link on our Facebook page for all the information of your books.
Good.
And it's Paul Dickson, D-I-C-K-S-O-N. Yeah. And you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Speaking of some American history that you've written about, tell everyone about Bonus Army, an American epic. It's a fascinating story. Tell everybody about this one.
Well, the World War I vets who were not well treated, the guys who fought World War I, were paid $1 a day during service and $1.50 for combat service. And after the war, they were voted a bonus. But then Congress got stingy and stingier and stingier, and they decided not to pay the bonus, which was another $1 a day. So it wasn't a huge amount of money for every day they served, but not pay it until 1945. And these guys, Depression came along in 1930, 31, 32, and these guys were really needing the money. So a group of them, starting in Portland, Oregon, marched on Washington, not to protest as much as sort of lobby for the early payment of their bonus, which they felt they were due. And it mushroomed. The more and more guys came, and eventually the bonus was voted down. They refused to leave, and they were driven out of D.C., Washington, by General Douglas MacArthur, and they burned them out. They were burned out, and it pretty much, as we show in the book that I wrote with Tom Allen, we pretty much showed that that was the end of Hoover. I mean, the defection of the Bonus Army on the eve of the election that elected Franklin D. Roosevelt and changed history. Mm. But the also the experience of the bonus guys, they finally paid the bonus in 1938, and I mean 1937, and but the experience is so traumatic because the American people are on the side of the vets. Is that it? That gets the GI Bill done early. They realize they can't do this. They can't pull all these people out of their houses, you know, with a draft, throw them in the army, and then when they get out, just let them go. And they have to make some sort of a cushion to get them out of, you know, out of the service and into civilian life. So, but for World War II comes along and they realize, you know, well before D-Day, well before the invasion of Europe, Congress realized we got to make a big cushion for the World War II guys. And of course, the lesson in all that was that those guys coming out of World War II on the GI Bill who got to buy farms and got to start businesses, start to go to college, graduate school, they were the ones that sort of, you know, paved the way for the boom years after World War II. They were the guys who went to college and, you know, learned chemistry and came up with miracle drugs and, you know, built huge housing developments and did remarkable things for the country.
You know, it's amazing to me that, you know, as you write about, Douglas MacArthur actually led tanks through the streets.
With Patton. With bayonets and stuff. And what he did, he disobeyed President Hoover's order. President Hoover said, don't go across the Anacostia Bridge where the bonus marchers had an encampment. If you know the geography of D.C., they had driven them out of downtown with the tanks and the bayonets and the gas and everything else, tear gas. They driven them over the bridge. And Hoover had been explicit in saying, don't leave them alone once they're out of downtown.
Yeah.
But he disobeyed the president, and he goes across the bridge and burns them out. And that, those photos of these guys being burned out and, you know, flames and children running for cover and everything, those hit the newsreels. And for the first time in American history, Americans go to the movie theaters to see the newsreels, and they're booing the U.S. Army. Because the U.S. Army is being used to get, you know, push the heroes of World War I out of the streets.
Yeah.
So,
wow, amazing.
Amazing.
And you actually got to speak with some of the final survivors of that, correct?
Yeah, quite a few. And some, it was really an experience. And some of them who had been gassed, they were mostly young kids at the time, but... And the very interesting thing about the bonus encampment, it was racially integrated. It was a threat in a funny way to the people who wanted to keep the military segregated. One of the reasons I think MacArthur was so upset with the bonus marchers, and he hints at this at several points, is you'd go down to the bonus army or their camp where there were women and children and the veterans. But you'd walk by a tent, and there'd be black feet and white feet sticking out of the same tent.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and a lot of early civil rights leaders looked at this and said, "Oh my gosh!" And the reason they had this total racial integration of the camp was the whites and the blacks were both being marginalized equally by society, and they were both being deprived of what had been promised them.
Mm.
So
yeah, wow. Listen, Paul, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Paul Dixon is with us. He's a tremendous writer and a really interesting guy. Always a great time to have him on. We figured during this patriotic week, yesterday was the 4th of July, that we would talk about some American stuff. And when we come back, we're going to talk about baseball. He's written several baseball books. And we'll come back and talk about that more with Paul Dixon right here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Hi, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell and Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the talk and text. You can check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/NickDShow. Follow us on Twitter at NickDShow. My guest right now is Paul Dixon, the author of over 60 books, including many books on the American experience and on baseball. His latest is Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son, and we had Paul on to talk about that at the release of the book, and we welcome Paul back. Paul, how's that book doing?
Really well. We just got a contract for an audio version, which is now a lot of fun because I think it's a very listenable book. But, we're getting great reviews. We're getting a lot of attention. And Leo is still stirs the pot. I mean, a lot of people are – a couple of people have criticized me because I wasn't rough enough on Leo, especially regarding the 69 season and the Cubs.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people were moved to, you know, be a little bit Chicago-centric here. One of the things that disturbed a lot of people the most about the book, and there were a lot of good points to Leo. Leo had moments that he transcended being a jerk, but his the inexplicable way he treated Ernie Banks, nobody could ever figure it out. I mean, he landed in Chicago, and the thing he wanted to do most, or not most, but almost most, was get rid of Ernie Banks, and he did everything he could to do it. And the Wrigley stood by Banks, but Leo did just really hated him. In fact, if you go back and look at Leo's book, Nice Guys Finish Last, he spends, I think, 6 pages telling the reader how bad a baseball player Ernie Banks was.
Oh, my God.
And, I think he blew that season. I think there's no question that without he was in such disarray and so angry at his own players. And, you know, during that season, if a player came to him and said, "Skipper, my arm's killing me. I just can't pitch, nine innings," he'd punish him by making him pitch 9 innings.
Man. No, it's a terrific book. And I have to say, Paul, you know, having had the incredible joy and honor of knowing Ron Santo, getting to know him through the radio station, being a colleague of his, I've heard stories about Ron's relationship with Leo, and it wasn't good.
Yeah, no, he picks the day that Ron Santo is gone. He goes to the Wrigley's and he wants to have a special day,
right,
for diabetes.
Right.
He was going to tell the world that day that he had that it was the severest form of diabetes,
right.
And Leo misinterprets it and thinks that it's Santo going to the Wrigley's to set up a special day just for Ron, not for diabetes.
Right.
I mean, he completely misunderstood Santo. And when they had the famous, as you know, when they had the famous player revolt, the second one that Leo had, he had one in Brooklyn where the players revolted. Santo had him in a headlock.
Yeah.
There were people who claimed he was on the road to killing him.
Right. Yeah, true story. Crazy stuff. But it's a terrific book. And speaking of baseball, you also have a book called Baseball, the President's Game. And to kind of tie in to what we were talking about in the first segment, tell everybody about that book and the connection that presidents have had to baseball.
Well, I mean, it's phenomenal when you look at the whole thing. The only president we could find who really didn't go, had never even went to a baseball, was Rutherford B. Hayes.
Mm.
Teddy Roosevelt is the only president who claimed he didn't like baseball, but he went to a number of games. He thought, in fact, Teddy Roosevelt thought it was a mollycoddle. And he said it wasn't a manly game like tennis, which is good enough. I mean, it's an opinion, but it
right.
didn't really pan out.
Right.
But the guys who were just, some of them had a remarkable time. I mean, Woodrow Wilson coached or was the faculty advisor for baseball at both Princeton and at Wesleyan University, where I went to school. There's a Wesleyan Rock. I mean, a Woodrow Wilson Rock at Wesleyan, where you're celebrating him as a coach. Other presidents just, I mean, George Bush Sr. Was probably the closest thing he had to a really good player. I mean, he was that good. He came out of World War II, and he played for Yale. When Yale was sort of at the highest, they would be sort of Final Four in baseball. And he plays, he really is a good player. In fact, he hits for the cycle in one game against the University of North Carolina.
Wow.
In college. And he was as good as they got. Because the guys he was playing against were the best players coming out of the service. And so, but he loved the game. He desperately loved it. Jimmy Carter loved softball. Wasn't much of a baseball fan, but he's a bat and ball guy. He loved to play softball. He while he was in the White House, he's, you know. So it goes on and on, and there are just so many great stories about those guys and what was going on with baseball.
And you mentioned George Bush Sr., but also George W. Bush was...
Oh, yeah, he was an owner. The first edition of that book was blurbed by George W. Bush when he owned the Texas Rangers. That's how long ago we wrote the book.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, he was... Yeah, it was a fun subject to do.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know. Like I always like it when you know presidents throw out the first pitch at games and things like that. And of course, you know, being a Chicagoan, we all know that Obama's allegiance is to the White Sox.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right. Well, listen, always a pleasure to talk to you, Paul. It's just great, and I love your writing, and I think your books are great. Your latest book is Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. It'll soon be out as an audio book. Do you have any time frame on that, Paul?
Oh, it's going to be out in August.
In August, okay.
Yeah, no, and the book is chugging along. We're selling it nicely, and people are sending me wonderful messages about it.
Yeah, and
you
again,
they loved Leo. How much they hated him.
And again, another Chicago connection in your baseball book. You wrote a book about Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick, which is another tremendous book that you know Chicagoans should check out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Paul, you're the best, man. Thanks for joining us this morning.
You too, Nick. Thanks.
Okay, take care. There you go. Paul Dixon, a great guy, amazing guest, fascinating, terrific writer, and writes about everything and has a great time doing it. So there you go. All right, we're going to take a break here for the news on 720 WGN.